and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium for a presentation given by UAA Chancellor Fran Ulmer on the BP Oil Spill Commission report. Ulmer was one of seven people appointed by President Obama to investigate the causes of the Gulf spill and make recommendations to prevent future spills from offshore drilling. Recorded on January 19th in Anchorage, Fran Ulmer discusses the Oil Spill Commission report and the implications for future offshore oil development next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
Everyone, we're going to get started, so why don't you find a seat? We've, as you know, we have a packed day today. Today is the Arctic Day, so I want to welcome all of you to the session this morning. My name is Molly McCammon, and I'm Director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. So we're going to get going. Our keynote speaker this morning is someone who I think almost needs no introduction. Fran Ulmer has been a huge supporter of ocean and coastal research and monitoring during her more than 30 years of public service, culminating in service as Lieutenant Governor, as a member of the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, and most recently as Chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage, Alaska's largest university. She was recently tapped by President Obama to serve on the National Commission investigating the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. The commission released its final report last week, and Chancellor Ulmer will talk about its findings and recommendations and its implications for future oil and gas development, especially in the Arctic. Please join me in welcoming Fran Ulmer.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the invitation to speak today to talk a bit about the commission recommendations. I have to say at the beginning, just looking at this audience, I see a lot of familiar faces, people that I've worked with over the years. And I particularly want to say thanks to those of you who have helped over the last 6 months offer words of advice on the topic of the Oil Spill Commission. From industry to scientists, the Coast Guard, I see a lot of people in this room who either contributed by making phone calls, sending emails, actually testifying before the commission, or just taking me aside and giving me another view from your perspective of what needs to be done in the future. So I just want to say thanks to you and thanks to the University of Alaska for allowing me the time to serve as a commissioner. Just very briefly, I'd like to talk about what happened on April 20th, the commission, how it was formed. I'll talk briefly about the findings, but primarily what I'd like to do is concentrate on the recommendations that the commission has offered to both industry and government to make a safer operation for the United States of America. On April 20th, tragic accident, 11 people died, dozens of people injured. The beginning of a two-month tragedy of oil continuing to spill into the Gulf of Mexico. Since then, thousands of people have worked on the spill. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, and billions of dollars will be spent on trying to restore the Gulf of Mexico. It is a tragic accident that could have been avoided. It was preventable. And what we have learned through the last 6 months of really exploring the way in which the industry does business and the way in which government regulates that industry, we see a lot of opportunity for improvement. Briefly, a background on the commission itself. The president created it with seven members. It was an independent, bipartisan commission. We held our first meeting in New Orleans back in July. And I have to tell you, sitting there and listening to the testimony of people who were pouring their hearts out about what an impact the spill had on their lives. Fishermen, tourism, community leaders, people who worked in the industry. It was a huge deja vu moment for me going back to 1989 and the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And the pain and anguish that that spill wrecked upon the state of Alaska. That is exactly what I heard from the people who testified before us in New Orleans, people who were very concerned not only about the short-term implications, but the long-term implications to the ecosystem upon which they rely. I know this will come as a surprise to those of you who have not spent much time in the Gulf of Mexico, but Louisiana and Alaska are a lot alike. Think about it. The oil and gas industry, the fishing industry, the tourism industry, the special sense of place and culture associated with Cajuns and the Houma Indians and Alaska Natives, and subsistence and significant reliance on the very special place of both the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska. These places are a lot alike. And these economies are mixed in a way that makes it very, very difficult for people really to take sides. What they really want is what we all want, which is a safer oil and gas industry so that the multiple uses of these special places, whether it's in the Gulf of Mexico or in Alaska, can be used and preserved at the same time. So the commission had 6 months to do its work. Last Tuesday, we met with the president at the White House and delivered the report. We had the opportunity to spend some time with him and with his cabinet officials who were primarily responsible for dealing with this bill over the last 6 months. And we provided to them both a description of the root causes and some of the ways in which we believe we can prevent accidents in the future. That was our mission. We were not finding fault for purposes of liability. The lawsuits will take care of that. We were looking at the underlying root causes and trying to make recommendations about the future, both for industry and for government. So basically, our takeaway, if you want to just sum it up in one phrase, it's the compelling need for a culture of safety. And from that safety, both from the industry and from government, there will be extraordinary benefits, both in terms of the environment, the economy, the people who work in the industry, and all of the people who rely on those special places and the health of those ecosystem services that are provided by a healthy environment. That's the main takeaway. And unfortunately, we found that in the United States of America, we really don't have the safest operations. That came as a surprise to me, actually. If you just look at the numbers, there were 79 unintended blowouts between 1996 and 2006 in the Gulf of Mexico. They didn't result in the kind of tragedy that we experienced with the Deepwater Horizon blowout on the Macondo well. But they were nonetheless accidents that could have. The death rate in the offshore oil and gas industry in the Gulf of Mexico is 4 times higher than in the North Sea, and the North Sea is a much more challenging environment. What does that tell us? It tells us that we aren't the best in the world, but we'd like to be. And I believe that we can learn from peer nations that have had experiences of developing over time a safer industry. So here are the main points that we cover in our recommendations. And I don't know the extent to which you can read that, but just very briefly, improving the safety of the oil and gas offshore industry, safeguarding the environment, strengthening spill response planning and capacity, advancing our well containment capacity, because containing the spill is a heck of a lot better than having to clean up afterwards. Restoring the Gulf of Mexico, which is a big, important mission, a national priority. Ensuring financial responsibility of the companies that are doing business and utilizing this public resource, which is what our offshore oil and gas resources are. They belong to the people of the United States, and we have a fiduciary responsibility to assure that people who are developing them can develop them safely and financially responsibly. And anticipating frontier areas like the Arctic, and anticipating the challenges and preparing for them so that we can move forward with greater confidence than we have today. I'm going to cover just a few of these, but obviously the report is available on our website, and I'll flash up the website at the end of my talk so that you can see it. And I really encourage you to spend some time with the report. Let me talk, first of all, on sort of the key piece of what we're talking about, which is improving safety. And there's a role both for government and a role for the industry in doing that. And I want to acknowledge the fact that both industry and government have taken steps. I don't mean to suggest that they haven't in the months that have happened since the spill. There have been steps taken. But as the commission report lays out and our recommendations suggest, there is a lot more that can be done. So let me give you some examples of what I'm talking about. The industry can and should create its own separate safety institute, separate and apart from what government does, to really focus on best practices and peer review. Now, this is done in other high-risk industries, and the nuclear industry is a great example of that. The chemical industry, the airline industry these are high-risk industries that if there is one accident, everybody suffers because of the crisis in confidence and often in the economic associated fallout. We are encouraging the industry to set up a safety institute that actually enables them to raise everyone up, as opposed to simply allowing some to move forward in the safety arena well and others not. And we are challenging the industry to do that in order for both the industry and our nation and the economy and the people who work in the industry to be better prepared and use best available technology to be as safe as possible. We recommend that the Department of Interior, change not only the way it's structured to create a separate safety office that only focuses on safety as a part of their leasing process, not to be primarily preoccupied with how much land they can lease, but rather to be primarily preoccupied with safe operations. And most importantly, to change the way in which that regulation takes place. And now I'm not so much talking about more regulation as I'm talking about different regulation. And the way we describe that is risk management, risk analysis of particular wells, particular rig, and let's face it, on every rig, you're likely to have actually dozens of companies working together, the main operator plus contractors and subcontractors. So try to imagine in a high-risk operation, which offshore oil and gas, particularly deep water drilling, is, having multiple companies trying to come together to work as a team to manage high-risk environments. That's the situation that we find ourselves in this industry. And some other countries, Norway and UK in particular, have approached how to regulate that in a very different way, requiring a safety case analysis, the risk management of that particular well, that particular rig, those companies coming together to actually develop a risk management system for that particular rig. That changes the game in terms of how management works, the interrelationships between the companies and the operators, and we believe offers a very different approach than what we're using in the United States today. It doesn't mean you don't have the basic prescriptive requirements. It means that you have another level of risk management, which we found to be one of the root causes of the disaster. That is management, communication, risk analysis, and process safety, which is a very important piece of managing any very complex operation, particularly high-risk complex operations. So there are a number of other recommendations that we talk about specifically as it relates to industry and government and that relationship. But what this chart shows you is the rate of growth of offshore oil and gas, particularly in deep water, and the flat gray line, the funding for previous MMS, Minerals and Management Service. What you see is that pretty consistently, over the last several decades, Minerals Management Service has been starved of the very kinds of resources, both funding, training, expertise, and I would add political support to do the kind of regulation that really would make this a safer industry. And that anti-regulation attitude and the constraints from Congress and from a series of administrations in not giving MMS the tools they actually needed to be effective regulators is another piece of the puzzle that we are shining a light on in our report. So we are challenging Congress to fund the agency, now BOEM, previously MMS, and offer training, offer salary incentives so that they can hire competitively with industry to have the kind of technological expertise which is needed for an industry as complex as this one is. And we are suggesting that the funding for this, again, I realize that we are in a time when people are talking about cutting budgets, not adding to budgets, that the fees should come from the industry itself. That this is a cost of doing business, whether it's through the fees, through the leases. Other industries pay for their regulation. FCC in the communications industry is a great example. There are many others. We are cognizant of the fact that much of what we are recommending here is a regime shift to a very different kind of regulation and a very different level of partnership between industry and government to make sure that these public resources are harvested in as safe a possible manner as possible. And we are encouraging Congress and the administration to look seriously at the kind of financial and political support that they need to give to our regulators and the kind of encouragement that they should provide to the private sector to be good partners with us, good stewards of our resources. We also recommend raising the liability cap because at $75 million, it is simply out of touch with reality in terms of what an accident like this one has cost. And we think it sends the wrong signal to industry in terms of balancing risk and reward. So we are recommending increasing the cap, and we are recommending that government take a much more serious look at the financial capability of companies that are engaged particularly in deep water offshore oil and gas drilling in the United States. There are a lot of other recommendations associated with safety, but in the interest of time, let me move on to another major area that we address, and that is spill response and containment. It was quite surprising to many of us that we saw much of the same technology that was used in the Exxon Valdez oil spill being used in the Gulf of Mexico. And it maybe shouldn't be that much of a surprise that there wasn't that much of a financial incentive for either government or industry to invest significant capital in spill response and containment technology when there wasn't a perceived risk that they were going to have to pay for, either because of, you know, their general sense of things are going fine, so why should we invest in this without financial support from government or without incentives from government to do so. It didn't happen. So unfortunately, we saw, you know, it was, again, a deja vu back to the Exxon Valdez oil spill days of booms and skimmers that didn't work all that well, burning with very limited applications. Obviously, the dispersants that were used created a great deal of controversy in the Gulf of Mexico, very different way of deploying dispersants that have been done before. The complete lack of capacity to contain the spill, which of course went on for almost 2 months, and the need for both industry and government to step up its game, both from the standpoint of research and development, but also from the standpoint of actually deploying and testing different ways in which we can be better prepared if another major spill happens, whether it's in the Gulf of Mexico or anywhere else. So there are quite a few recommendations that relate to changing the game, changing the way in which oil spill response plans are reviewed, and by whom. Again, it came as quite a surprise to most people that in the Gulf of Mexico, there was not a formal review process for agencies that had a lot of expertise to contribute to oil spill response plans, NOAA, Coast Guard, EPA, not to mention the public, and a lack of engagement between the national contingency plan, the area response plans, the specific plans that were submitted by particular companies for specific programs. This ability to link those up in an effective way so that response was better coordinated. There are quite a few recommendations in the report regarding that, in addition to the need for the U.S. government to really invest in the kind of serious analysis associated with these response plans, because clearly, in the Deepwater Horizon spill, the plans that were put on the table and approved had no relationship to reality in terms of what they could actually do, either in terms of containment or response. So a lot of room for improvement. Let's move on to restoration. The Gulf of Mexico is a very special place that is important not only to the people of the Gulf, but to the nation. It is a national treasure. And unfortunately, it is a national treasure that has been in decline for quite some time. It was not just on April 20th that the Gulf of Mexico experienced a rather significant setback in its health and the health of that ecosystem. For many reasons, which we do not have time to go into today, the loss of wetlands, the oxygen-deprived dead zones as a result of runoff from the Mississippi River draining the farmlands of the Midwest. I could go on and on in some detail about the unfortunate state of affairs in terms of a very severely compromised ecosystem and the need for us as a nation to stand up and use this tragedy as an opportunity to invest in the Gulf of Mexico and restore it to the best of our ability. So we recommend that 80% of the clean water fines from this accident be dedicated to restoring the Gulf of Mexico. And although in this day and age, again, back to sort of the state of politics in Washington, D.C., there will be a tremendous tendency, that big sucking sound, to just use whatever penalties and, you know, come in from this to just go to the general treasury. We are saying that would be another tragedy visited upon the Gulf of Mexico and the people of the region. So we make quite a few recommendations in the report about how this might happen, how the restoration might be effective. We look at what was done here in the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council and the extent to which they use science as a guideline, the extent to which the plans that have already been laid out in the Gulf of Mexico, and believe me, there are lots of plans. Planning has been underway for a long time in that region. Again, not relating to this spill, but relating to the many years of damage to that ecosystem. So there are plans in place that attempt to balance the various uses of that region for fish, for tourism, for local use, for oil and gas, and the extent to which some of the things that we learned from the Exxon Valdez, and I want to publicly acknowledge Molly and many others who shared with the commission and with the people of that region, lessons learned from the Exxon Valdez Trustees Council and how we have had a long legacy of science-based decisions and restoration in a very important and transformational way. Obviously, there is damage beyond what I can even describe this morning. There are estimates in terms of damage to wildlife. There is tremendous concern about human health implications associated with the spill, with the spill cleanup, with the use of dispersants, with on and on and on. When we were in New Orleans last week, I should mention, after we reported to the president, we went back to the Gulf of Mexico. We went to Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Texas, we hit all of those states reporting back to the people of the Gulf of Mexico about our recommendations. A lot of what we heard last week was about health concerns, health for the environment, health for turtles and birds, health for people in the region. Unfortunately, that isn't something that, as a commission, we were either charged with focusing on or that we had time to really address. But it is a lingering concern, not only for the people of that region, but it was, as you know, a lingering concern here in Alaska, and to some extent still is today. So there are many challenges ahead of additional things that need to be done, both by agencies, not just the Department of Interior, but all of the collaborating agencies, EPA and NOAA and the Coast Guard and many others, to try to address the concerns of that region. Well, finally, with the time that I have left, let me address the frontier areas and the Arctic. Specifically, this was not our mission. That is to say, the president in his original executive order that created the commission did not specifically say, please address frontier areas or please concentrate on the Arctic. He did, however, ask us to make recommendations about how to improve the safety of the industry in the future. And we felt, because of the interest not only that industry has in this region, but the importance of this region to not only people who live here, but to the entire nation, that we needed to think about listen to people and address this, at least at a general level. We made no attempt, because it was way outside of our assignment, to pass judgment on any specific projects that are in front of the government today for approval processes. We felt that that was not something that was part of our mission, and frankly, we did not have all of the information that one would need to substitute our judgment for those of the people who are on the front lines of decision making with regard to specific projects. So we backed up and looked at the long term and asked ourselves, what makes the Arctic unique, and what are some of the things that one needs to do to be prepared for development in the Arctic, whether it happens next year or 5 years from now or 10 years from now? What are some of the ingredients that we as a nation, both the industry and government and the people of this state, need to be thinking about? Needless to say, we decided, and with a great deal of testimony being presented by many parties, that the Arctic is a very special place with very special challenges. And I don't need to tell the people in this room what those are. But they do demand a different way of doing business. And they require us to do research not only about the ecosystem, what's there, what's unique, what areas are particularly special, under what conditions, where, when, and how can development be done as safely as possible, but also research R&D in spill response and preparedness and containment in Arctic conditions. Because although some work has been done by both governments abroad, Norway, et cetera, as well as industry, some research in oil spill in ice conditions, there's still a lot we do not know that we are speculating about and that we would like to know more about. So we are encouraging both industry and government to step up to the plate and do the research that is in a collaborative way, both on the ecosystem and on research and development, on not only oil spill response and containment, but also best practices to use the technology that is appropriate in Arctic conditions to increase the level of safety in the Arctic. We also talk quite a bit about the importance of doing this as a region, not just as a country. And this map, I think, reminds us that we are in this together with Russia and with Canada and with Greenland and with Norway. The Arctic is a very special place, and it is a place where we can partner with other northern neighbors to set best practices and high standards for Arctic development. And so we specifically recommend that the United States take a leadership role through the Arctic Council and other mechanisms to actually develop, evolve these Arctic-specific technologies, best practices, spill response technologies, and collaborate in a way that recognizes that as neighbors, we have a vested interest in making sure that everybody raises their game in this very special place, not just one country. We do also talk about the Coast Guard. And I just have to say this, the Coast Guard is such an important player in the state of Alaska, but not everybody in the lower 48 understands how important the Coast Guard is to the people of this state, whether it's in fisheries management, search and rescue, or all the other many, many things that the Coast Guard does. I think we all recognize that a significant national investment will need to be made for the Coast Guard to be able to have the assets needed to do business in the Arctic. And when I talk about doing business, I don't just mean in terms of supervising an oil spill response in the Arctic. I'm talking about navigation. I'm talking about tourism. I'm talking about the wide variety of human impacts that are likely to increase over time as the Arctic warms and as the ice recedes. So we recommend a significant investment in the Coast Guard. Of course, we hope that Congress is listening, because for many of these recommendations, they can be done within the executive branch. Some of them can be done by industry by themselves. Some of them require Congress, and we are hopeful that Congress acts as opposed to being on the sidelines. And let's just remember what happened after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We passed OPA 90 within a very short period of time, requiring a wide variety of changes in how we do business. Think about the other changes. Double hull tankers increased escorts for tankers in and out of Prince William Sound. I could go on and on. I don't have the time to do that. But this country learned from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Maybe not everything we needed to learn in terms of changing business practices, but we did a lot. That's what we hope will happen as a result of this very unfortunate tragedy in the Gulf of Mexico. That Congress, the President, the agencies, the industry will step up and use this as an opportunity to improve their game so that we can take pride in how we do business in the United States of America. This shows you the oil spill website. I encourage you to go to the website. There are several downloadable versions of both the summaries. I do have some summaries of the recommendations out on the table. The book itself, the full report, is almost 400 pages, but it's really well written and it's a fun read. And then there's a shorter version. It is a great read. I know that sounds really weird, but we had some fabulous writers on staff who brought alive the history of the oil and gas industry, the special region of the Gulf of Mexico, and really bring a sense of passionate commitment to making change happen. I hope you and others will be part of the chorus of Americans that say, it's time to do better. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to UAA Chancellor Fran Ulmer's presentation at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium. Ulmer was one of seven people appointed by President Obama to serve on the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission. She presented the findings detailed in the Oil Spill Commission report at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage on Wednesday, January 19, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.